Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
We're going to jump in. I should say by way of introduction that this is not going to be a comprehensive overview of the ways in which sort of Catholic moral tradition differs from and is similar to the Kantian utilitarian theories which we're going to focus on. I originally planned on having like a nice discussion of how they disagree about the nature of the good and they disagree about the nature of the right. And then once I hit 16 pages on my handout, I realized we had to make other plans. So there'll be various places where I say, like, and there's more on this in the appendix to your handout if you want to look at that and ask me about it in the Q&A. Just be forewarned that that's going to happen, and you may be left sort of annoyed that I, you know, brought up questions that were not resolved. But it was a inevitable consequence of, time. So let's jump right in. What I want to start with in this first part of the talk is just trying to clarify some useful terminology that helps us think more precisely about where different ethical theories differ from one another. Philosophers tend to use terms technically. The problem is they don't always use terms technically the same way as everyone else who's using these terms technically, and it can produce a lot of confusion about what we mean when someone says this is a good and someone else says that's good. So I'm going to be giving some technical terms. It'll be largely consistent with the way they're used in contemporary philosophy, but there'll be some idiosyncratic elements just necessary for me to specify how I'm interpreting it against various interlocutors. So it's going to be the more boring part of the talk, but it's important. So you can see at the very top of your handout, or sort of bottom of the first page of your handout, a basic diagram of the terminology that I'm going to think is really important to clarify what we're going to be talking about. And it starts with a distinction between the good, which we can largely think about the things that we value, and the right, which governs how it is that we want to respond to these things of value. And this is an easy enough phenomenon to intuit when you notice that we don't respond to all types of value the same way. So there are towns in the United States which make it against the law to cut down trees unless you plant new ones. These towns suggest that trees are good. They in some way value trees. Perhaps they value them instrumentally or for aesthetic reasons, all sorts of explanations, but they value trees, right? Exactly how they value it, we don't know, but they value trees. And they say the right way to respond to the good of trees is to preserve their number. We don't have to maximize the number of trees, right? We don't need to constantly plant more trees. But if you chop one down, you have to plant a new one. So there's a way in which we value trees, and we respond to the good of trees by making sure we preserve the number of trees. Now, most towns also have laws that express a certain value in children, right? And I think we all, in the way we value, as we value trees, we also value children. But we don't respond to the value of children the same way. We don't think the way we value the good of children is by preserving the number. Because if I'm pulling out of my driveway one day and not looking where I'm going and run over the neighbor's kid and kill them, I can't go up to the neighbor and be like, look, I'm really sorry, right? Your kid's dead, but don't worry, right? My wife's pregnant right now and you can have our replacement. In whatever way we value children, we don't treat them as fungible the way in which we might treat my neighbor's mailbox as fungible. If I'm pulling out of my driveway and don't notice where I'm going and knock over their mailbox, it does seem appropriate for me to go and be like, look, I'm really sorry I destroyed your mailbox, but don't worry, I'm heading to Home Depot right now. I'll get you a replacement and come and install it for you. We have these things that we value and we respond to them quite differently. If you're at a restaurant and you have various options, all similarly priced, similarly healthy, but one's tastier than the other, you're likely to pick the tastier option. And similarly, if there's another one that's even tastier still, you're likely to pick that one. And you're unlikely to get to the point where you say, no, that'd be too tasty. I don't want one that tasty, right? I'm good with this level. Right? No. If some tastiness is good, more tastiness is better. And so we tend to, all else equal, treat tastiness as a sort of good that we want to maximize or promote or bring about to the greatest extent possible. But there are other things we value in very different ways, which that just sounds crazy. For instance, laws seem like a good thing. I'm like that with our laws. Laws have a kind of value. But we don't think that therefore we should just maximize laws or have as many laws as possible. We don't even think that we should maximize like law conformity. Because we could trivially pass a bunch of laws that would be fulfilled, increasing the ratio of actions that are law governed. And that is just totally irrelevant to anything we might care about in the domain of political philosophy. The US government could right now pass a bunch of laws that say it's illegal to export armadillos to Jupiter. It's illegal to export guava fruit to Jupiter. Everyone is going to obey this law. We would have so much obedience to these laws. But that isn't the sort of thing that we care about. We don't respond to the good of law by maximizing the amount of legal obedience that occurs, or maximizing the ratio of legal obedience to disobedience, or something of that sort. Now, with this distinction in mind, right, we can sort of focus in on different ways to compare ethical theories. For the most part, ethical theories disagree about the nature of what it is that's good. They disagree about, ultimately, how we understand what it is that's good. And that's where most ethical debate focuses. But there's also some disagreement that can happen even once you agree on the good. Because, you know, for most of these, it's pretty obvious. If you value laws, you're not going to want to maximize the number of laws. If you value children, you're not going to just want to preserve the number of children. If you value trees, you're not going to, you know, want to treat them as ends of themselves. The way you're going to respond to these different types of value generally dictates what you plausibly find the right way to respond to them. But sometimes it's less clear. So to give an example, I owe to Marcia Baron, who's a great Kantian philosopher. She says, look, imagine this is a university which really values freedom of speech. They regard it really important that people can sort of tolerate dissenting views, and it's an open culture, very willing to be challenged on the things we, you know, most firmly cherish. And then there's a student group on campus that wants to bring in a speaker, and this speaker is well known for giving these impassioned and utterly compelling criticisms of freedom of speech. And this person is known to be so persuasive that administrators think it's very likely that if we bring this speaker onto campus, that our campus is going to become much less welcoming towards free speech values and much more hostile to dissenting views. And that in general, the sort of campus culture will become far more narrow-minded and less open to sort of tolerating views that fall outside what's considered sort of socially acceptable. And here you can imagine two administrators both appealing to the value of free speech, either to defend letting this person speak on campus, or to defend not letting them speak on campus. If you think we really value free speech, so we need to promote free speech as much as possible, you're going to say don't invite them, because there'll be less free speech. But if you say we really value free speech, so we have to let them come, you're saying we must respect the value of free speech. We can respond differently depending on if we think free speech is something to be promoted, something to be brought about, or instead something to be respected, something that constrains what actions it is that we treat ourselves as options. Nevertheless, for the most part, the sort of deep disagreements in ethical theory tend more on the side of disagreements about the nature of good. And so in this talk, I'm going to focus more on the nature of disagreements about good, but if you want in the Q&A, we can talk more about how these views differ, about how to understand what's right and wrong, even once you accept certain views about what is good. So let's clarify a little bit more how to think about good. And here I'm going to use some distinctions that Christine Korsgaard makes in a very famous paper, Two Distinctions in Goodness. And in this paper, she points out that you'll very often talk as though there's a contrast between intrinsic good and instrumental good. And she, I think, quite rightly points out this is a kind of an odd contrast, because normally you'd think the opposite of intrinsic would be extrinsic, and that we can actually distinguish two different contrasts that people tend to run together. So one is the distinction between instrumental value, things that are only valuable as a means to an end, and final value, something we value as an end in itself, something we don't get because it gets us something else that we care about. Another distinction is the distinction between intrinsic value, which is something we think has value in itself in some fashion, and something that's extrinsically valuable, where we think it gets its value because we value something else, even if this thing that we value because of that other thing is something we value not as a means to some further end. And sometimes students struggle to understand why there would be such things as extrinsic final value, things that aren't instrumentally valuable. We can give this example, right? Suppose my grandfather, before he died, left me in his will his pocket watch. And this pocket watch might not be very nice, right? Perhaps if I sold it at a pawn shop, it'd only get me like a dollar or two. Nevertheless, I might really cherish it. I don't cherish it as a means to an end. It's not like it's going to be useful because otherwise I'll forget about my grandfather, right? It's not instrumentally helpful to some other end. Nevertheless, though, its value to me depends extrinsically on me valuing my grandfather. I only value this pocket watch because I value my grandfather. If I found out that the person who gave me this pocket watch wasn't my grandfather, but an imposter who tricked my family into paying his medical bills at the end of his life, I'm likely not going to value the pocket watch the same way as I did previously. Because the value of the pocket watch was not found internal to the pocket watch, it instead was referred extrinsically to the value of this other person who gave it to me. And so we can talk then about things that are intrinsic final goods. What these are, very controversial question. right? Plausible candidates here would be things like God, or for the utilitarian, pleasure, or for the Aristotelian, something like happiness understood as activity in accordance with virtue. Then we can also have things that are straightforwardly instrumentally valuable. These are relatively less controversial. These are things like money. You only value money because you can use it to get something else that you value, right? The money is only useful as a means to an end to get something else. You know, I would put things like vaccines here and jogging. I know people who just like jogging. They're crazy to me, right? Jogging is only tolerable because it makes you healthier, right? Anyone who does something is like fundamental failure to understand the nature of the good, it seems to me. But then there are all these things which we don't value as a means to an end. We value for their own sake. There's lots of stuff we value for its own sake. But it's unclear if it's because it in itself has value or because its value gets referred to something else. And this is where the real meat of disagreement between different ethical theories lies. How do we explain the priority between the things that are final intrinsic goods and the value of things that are final extrinsic goods? So to give one example here, we can contrast the utilitarian and the Kantian as giving very different answers to how we articulate the value of something like happiness. For the utilitarian, happiness or pleasure is the final intrinsic good. It's the thing that has value. And we value living things as a means to have a kind of receptacle in which that value can exist. Right? It's good to bring about more human beings. Why? Because if we have a bigger population, there can be more happiness. Right? There are many utilitarians, such as Sidgwick, who have discussions about, like, how are we going to process the value of populations? In general, if people tend to be happy in their lives, we want a bigger population because it means there's more happiness in the world, and the happiness is something we're after. To someone like Immanuel Kant, this just sounds crazy. Because it's true that I might want people to be happy. But if I want them to be happy, I don't want them to be happy because I value the happiness, it's because I value them. And because I value you, I therefore want you to be happy. And so for the Kantian, persons have an intrinsic final value, which explains extrinsically the value of happiness. Whereas for the utilitarian, happiness has an intrinsic final value, while persons have an intrinsic extrinsic final value because of the kind of receptacles in which this happiness can accrue. There are other ways to make the same point, right? So utilitarians tend to think that pleasure is an intrinsic good in the sense of it doesn't depend on merit. But Kant, in the first part of the groundwork, says we would only value happiness if we thought that happiness was in some way deserved. Right? He says, someone filled with no goodwill, but just sort of completely evil desire, right? You know, let's imagine like Hitler at the end of his life didn't, you know, commit suicide, but he faked his own death and escaped to the Swiss Alps, where he lived out the rest of his life, causing no more harm to anyone, but just eating Swiss chocolates and having a jolly old time. And Kant says, we don't regard the world as better for the extra happiness that's experienced by Hitler at the end of his life, because Kant thinks the value of happiness and pleasure depends extrinsically on the merit created by the goodwill of the person who experiences that pleasure. To utilitarian, this is totally wrong. We extrinsically care about merit because it creates incentive structures to encourage people to have good behavior. So it's useful not to reward people like Hitler because we want to create incentives for people to have good activity in the future. But it's not fundamentally because the dessert is the thing that really, really matters. Because that'd be a crazy view, the utilitarian says. Because if that's true, then like, why would animal happiness ever be good? But like, obviously you shouldn't torture ducks, even though ducks are monstrous and clearly don't like merit as far as goodwill to be happy. And so we get these disagreements between the Kantian and the utilitarian about the relative priority of persons versus happiness or between pleasure versus merit. Everyone's going to think punishment of the guilty is probably a good thing in general, right? Everyone's going to think pleasure and happiness are generally good in some way, though Kant has some complicated discussions in the second critique in which he says good is said in many ways. We don't have to get into the details here, right? Though if you want to in the Q&A, we can. But this is where the kind of meat of disagreement comes. Where do we explain the relative priority? Where's the fundamental thing that's good and which things are instead good for their own sake, good as final ends, but only because they participate in some fashion in a good that's external to them. You may be wondering about the sort of chart here. Why isn't there anything that's an intrinsic instrumental good? Well, because if it's an instrumental good, it gets its good by getting you something else, which would be good, and so it always has to be extrinsic, right? So instrumental goodness is a subspecies of extrinsic goodness, which is why if you're looking at the box, that one is not filled in. so now we're in a position to try to situate Thomistic axiology, right? If you're sort of Catholic or Thomist about the nature of goodness, how does the Thomistic view about what is good differ from a utilitarian or Kantian one? Because this is really what I want to take on, right? The assumption that, for the most part, the kind of moral theory that shapes contemporary cultural understandings tend either to be fundamentally utilitarian in character or tend to be fundamentally Kantian in character. And this is in contradistinction to an older, more Aristotelian, Thomistic approach to value, which is not nearly as sort of ubiquitous in a sort of general cultural understanding. And so we want to clarify how this Catholic Aristotelian sort of view differs from the kind of Kantian and the utilitarian. I should say here, for purposes of right now, I'm basically going to treat Aristotelian and Thomist as synonymous. In important senses, they're not. But I had to remove the entire section, which I, you know, situate Thomas against Aquinas for reasons of time. So, you know, we can get to that in the Q&A if people want to. But for now, we're just going to talk about a kind of approach that's sort of broadly Aristotelian, Thomistic in flavor. I'm also necessarily going to paper over a lot of really important differences amongst different utilitarians, right? So I'm going to not pay any attention, for example, to the difference between ACK and rule utilitarians, if you're familiar with this sort of distinction, right? I'm going to pretend that Mill and Sidgwick have basically the same view, which is crazy. Sidgwick has a great view, and Mill is a pretty good philosopher, right? But no, right, like, he doesn't touch Sidgwick in terms of sort of utilitarian, you know, brilliance. But we're gonna paper over that for now, and if people want, we can come back to it in the Q&A. Similarly, right, like, I'm just basically gonna treat Kant's view as the Kantian view, even though many contemporary versions of Kantianism are in pretty important ways distinct from a kind of orthodox Kantianism. But I'm going to try to focus on arguments that don't deal with that, right? Basically, all utilitarians, whether rule or act utilitarians, treat happiness as the kind of thing to be promoted, so I'm gonna focus my attacks there. Not all utilitarians agree about what happiness is. Some utilitarians are hedonists. They think that what happiness is pleasure. Others are preference satisfaction utilitarians. They think happiness is the ratio of desire satisfied versus not satisfied, right? We're going to ignore a lot of these distinctions unless people want to press them later. And I'm going to try to, you know, at the highest level of generality, finding that which is common to all utilitarians, how does it still differ from Thomism? Taking what's common to pretty much all Kantians, how does that still differ from Aristotelianism? That's sort of the project in this next section. So, part two, situating a Thomistic axiology. The first thing, and I do like this little chart I have on the bottom left here. It's going to basically be what I follow through. I think it's useful to see disagreements amongst these different parties basically as a series of choices. And I'm here ignoring the Platonist choice, which precedes all this, right? We're assuming no one's a Platonist, right? We can talk about Platonism also if we want to in the Q&A, but no one's a Platonist anymore today. And so while it's a live option in terms of the history of ethical theory, the kind of Platonist view of goodness, right, like, you know, G.E. Moore just didn't win out, right? Platonism never came back. So let's talk about the first distinction, which is whether or not the good is fundamentally a state of affairs. This is the utilitarian view. It is fundamentally a state of people experiencing pleasure or people having the desire satisfied. It is going to be a term we can call happiness, but what happiness is understood as a way the world is. And because it's a way the world is, it is fundamentally apt to be promoted, to bring about states of affairs in which people experience pleasure, or in which people have their desires satisfied. We can make it the case that the world is this way. This is subtly different from what goes on in, for example, Aristotelianism. Because if you read Aristotle, he says, the ultimate end is happiness. And if you read Mill, he says, the ultimate end is happiness. And if you read Aquinas, he says the ultimate end is happiness. And you can start to think that, you know, Aquinas is really just a sort of rule utilitarian. And actually, it's not crazy at times to interpret some of Aquinas' arguments as having a sort of rule utilitarian character. But there is this really important difference, that for Aristotle, he understands happiness not as a state of affairs to bring about, but an activity to engage in. I can be happy, and I can bring it about that there is happiness. And these are two very different attitudes towards what is good. One treats the happiness as something to promote. The other treats happiness as something to do. And so the first distinction we have is between those who view the good as a state of affairs to be promoted or an activity to perform. Once you have a view on which it's an activity to perform, there's a further distinction, which is a distinction that Aristotle draws in his Metaphysics between kinesis and energeia. Kinesis is an activity that in some sense aims at its own elimination. Crossing the street. I'm crossing the street, and we can tell this is kinesis, it aims at its elimination, because either I'm crossing the street or I've crossed the street. If I've crossed the street, I'm no longer crossing the street. If I'm still crossing the street, I've not yet crossed the street. The perfective and imperfective aspect exclude one another. If I am completing college, I'm not yet completed college. If I've completed college, I'm not yet completing college. This contrasts with other sorts of activities like friendship. Friendship does not aim at its own completion. It's not like, all right, the goal is to get through this friendship. All right, 20 years, friendship done. We've done it, right? We have completed the friendship. Similarly, if you say, yeah, we're friends, then we've been friends. Perhaps not very long, but to be a friend means you've been a friend. This is a, what we might say, logical or grammatical difference. It's not a difference in what the activity is. To see this, take the example of playing chess. Playing chess is an energeia. Me and my friend could be playing chess, and there's no particular time when that has to end. We could just play chess until we die if we wanted to. That's very different from playing a game of chess. Playing a game of chess does sort of aim at coming to a completion. Each of us is trying to win the game, and once we've played the game of chess, we're no longer playing that game of chess. And so playing a game of chess is a kind of kinesis. You're trying to finish it. Playing chess is a sort of endless activity that could just keep going indefinitely. It'll come to an end at some point, but it's sort of external to the thing that is playing chess that it comes to an end when it does. Now, I think I bring this distinction up mostly because I think basically all the serious philosophers we're going to talk about here, they regard the finally good activity as a kind of energeia, a kind of endless activity that's sort of open to indefinite extension. But I think there's a very real psychological tendency amongst many people to find the value of their life in a kind of accomplishment. Right. Think about the difference between the person who wants to advocate for the poor as a lawyer and the person who wants to make partner as a lawyer. One of these people will eventually achieve their goal, and it's not clear what they're supposed to do at that point. The other person doesn't have that same problem. Or as a parent, right, there's a very different attitude for me between wanting to raise my children into a sort of adult friendship with me and wanting to like get my children through college, at which point I've like done the parenting thing. It's very different attitudes. And I think a lot of us are very tempted to view the sort of goals of our life as fundamentally kinetic in character, as accomplishment-driven. And this is quite alien to the kind of moral theories that I'm going to bring up here when I talk about Kantianism and Aristotelianism. And so it's useful to draw this distinction because I don't want you thinking after activity as a kind of thing you're trying to accomplish and finish. I want you to think about them as something you kind of do and just keep doing as long as you're doing those things. And so once you think about activity that way, there is, for both Kant and Aristotle, a sense in which the activity we're doing is just the activity of the thing we are. But Kant and Aristotle have very different views about how we understand the thing we are from a morally salient standpoint. If you read the beginning of the preface to Kant's Groundwork, he talks about this a little bit, it's much clearer in the Second Critique, but I'll focus on the argument in the Groundwork because that's probably what's going to be more familiar if any of you have taken a course on Kant. The Second Critique doesn't tend to get covered as much for good reasons, much more difficult. But in the Groundwork, Kant says, look, whatever morality is, it has to be free of empirical content. It must be an activity of pure practical reason. Because what we are fundamentally is a rational creature. And what we care about, what we think, like, feel like what I must do, must stem from my rational nature. It can't stem from contingent facts about like my empirical biology. Kant thinks that ethics, qua ethical theory, is a matter of pure practical reason. And so it doesn't involve any facts about like my biology. Right? The activity I'm engaged in, the activity of rational activity, which is pure rational activity. For Kant, the obligations I have as a human being are fundamentally the same as the obligations a Martian has as a Martian. Or even, for Kant, the obligations an angel has, though Kant's view on angels is complicated. But if you watch like Star Trek is fundamentally a deeply kind of Kantian picture. Right? Because all of these different species can all come together in harmony and kind of live together with a shared kind of activity because they're all just doing this sort of rational thing. And sure, they're like the Ferengi who are like creepy free market capitalists, but like they kind of realize they're wrong in the end. Right? And so what we get, right, for Kant is the thought that, well, we fundamentally are rational creatures, right, engaged in rational activity, and kind of empirical facts about our biology, that's just kind of alienated from us and shouldn't bear any sense for, like, what really matters. This differs from the Aristotelian view, for which the activity we engage in is not rational activity, but human activity. The activity of a human being, which is a kind of biological reality. In Book 6, Nicomachean Ethics, Aristotle says that where theoretical reason concerns things like the true and the straight, or the white and the straight, which would be true for all species, practical wisdom concerns things like the healthy and the good, which would differ for each species. A good human life looks different from a good Martian life, because Martians and humans are fundamentally different kinds of things. And so for the Aristotelian and for the Thomist, we find the activity that sets the sort of end for ethics, that good activity, that intrinsically final activity that is supposed to be the orienting thing from which all ethical theory is done, as something that takes sort of very serious recognition of the sort of deep substantive particularities of the sort of thing that we happen to be. It's not a thin rationality to be shared by us and any other creature capable of reflection. And so, right now we have a sort of basic schema. The first distinction, we have the utilitarians who think the good is something to be promoted, a state of affairs, and Kantians and Aristotelians who think it's an activity. Amongst those who think it's an energetic activity, we can then divide between think it's activity of rational activity versus human activity. And if we wanted to, they're not going to get it detailed, we can say the difference between Aquinas and Thomas is that Aquinas thinks it's a fundamentally eternal activity, a sort of transcendent activity. Right, because for Aquinas, God is outside the world, whereas for Aristotle, God's kind of like a part of the world, just the best part. And so you get a kind of very different view about whether or not our final ends kind of transcends, or sort of human nature's a sort of transcendent participation. But we're not going to get into those distinctions unless we want to in the Q&A. So now we have this sort of picture in place, and so we can talk about which of these views is more plausible, right? Are there good reasons to take the kind of Thomistic Aristotelian approach, which I think there are? And I want to start, though, on sort of the question of, like, should we view the good as a kind of activity or a state of affairs to be promoted? And so here I am on page 3 of your handout, the Assessing the Utilitarian Axiology. And before I argue that utilitarianism is wrong and deeply mistaken, I first want to say, I think utilitarians tend to get a bad rap in Catholic circles. I think probably the sort of consequentialism of most act utilitarians means they get a pretty bad rap. But I think there's a lot that's really rich and valuable in the utilitarian tradition. For instance, I think that when you read Aquinas, a lot of what he says reads very much like the sort of thing a rule utilitarian would say. I think there's lots of pretty deep similarities between those. And what's more, we have to give credit to the fact that the utilitarian movement has a really laudable record in terms of promoting real moral improvement for society, right? Whether we're talking about things like the abolitionist movement of slavery, women's suffrage, opposition to factory farms, emphasis on the elimination of global poverty, right? Like, utilitarians have done a remarkably good job of getting the right conclusions about things that were unpopular at the time when utilitarians started talking about them. Nevertheless, I do think there is a problem with the sort of fundamental axiological commitment that views happiness as a state of affairs to be promoted. And to see why, let's maybe start with a case. So I believe I include this case. Yeah. So towards the bottom of page 3, I have this sort of central objection. Utilitarianism reverses the explanatory place of happiness. And let's start with this case. So suppose I enter my class right next week, come into my class on Tuesday, and I say, guess what, everyone? I have great news. My archenemy, the one who killed like half my family and burned ancestral land, he just got a huge promotion at work. He's going to be so happy. Isn't that great? My class will be confused. They'll be like, what are you talking about? I thought you hated him. I'm like, well, yeah, I hate him. I'm not glad for his sake. I'm glad for the happiness. Right? It's not good that he, sure, I guess it'd be better if the happiness, but you know, the happiness happens where the happiness happens, right? It's that, it's from the standpoint of the universe, it's the universe that has more happiness than I'm glad about. It's not that I'm glad that he's happy. It's the happiness that I'm concerned with here. You'd probably be confused, right? And you'd be confused because it's not clear that it even makes sense to talk about the value of happiness except in terms of the value of that happiness to someone. The way Christine Korsgaard makes this point, which I find quite sympathetic, she says, happiness has a kind of tethered value. The happiness is good, but it's good for the person who has that happiness. Or it's good for the people who love that person who has that happiness. So it's good for me that my kid is happy. It's good for my kid that my kid is happy. But it's not clear it makes sense that it's good for the universe that my kid is happy, unless we think the universe loves my kid. It's not the happiness that we care about most fundamentally. We'll talk about this a little bit more. We'll give sort of another version of this argument in a second. But we can make a similar point when we talk about pleasure. And that pleasure also seems to depend extrinsically on what pleasure is taken in. And here I'm going to cheat a little bit, right? The like deep argument for this in Aristotle is complicated. And so I'm going to give a case that probably slightly prejudges the case. And if you want to push back on me, there's good reasons to push back, and we can address it in the Q&A. But I just want to evoke the intuition for you, because I often find it hard to evoke the intuition, that pleasure is only good when taken in good things. So here's another case, right? This is on the top of page 4, the pleasant torture case. Suppose I'm kidnapped with one of my children by a sadistic torturer. I'm forced to watch as my child is tortured. I think all these would be a horrible experience. Horrible for my child, horrible for me. But now let's suppose that the torturer also uses an electrode to activate the pleasure center of my brain, causing me to experience these euphoric waves of pleasure at the sight of my child being tortured. Now we have this question: is the situation better or worse for my experiencing pleasure in the situation? And my own intuition is that the situation is a whole lot worse. Because fundamentally, it's wrong to think about pleasure as a freestanding good thing. It's not like, that was a horrible experience, it should never happen, but at least it was a silver lining that I really enjoyed it. That's a deeply morally confused way. The way Tal Brewer puts it, which I like, is he said, like, that's a prelude to nihilism, not a serious moral commitment. And that's because there's this ancient moral principle that you find in Plato and Aristotle and Aquinas, which is that pleasure is not itself the good. Pleasure is that which perfects that which is already good. So you can think about pleasure as kind of like belief. Sometimes you see these signs. My grandma has this sign. She says, believe outside. Believe what? Right? Belief is not a good thing. Believing true things is great, but believing false things is bad. Right? Similarly, statement, enjoy is a bad lesson. Enjoy good things. But you shouldn't enjoy bad things. To enjoy bad things makes the situation worse, not better. Enjoyment perfects a good thing if it's already good, but it can't make that thing good. So what, then, is the Catholic alternative? Ultimately here, I think the Catholic alternative says that what has to be central is love, and love is not something you can have for pleasure. Love is not something you can have for happiness. Love is something you can have for a person or an animal, and because you have it for a person or animal, you can therefore want them to be happy or to enjoy life. But the attitude of love cannot grip pleasure. It cannot grip happiness. It has to grip a being, a substance, a living thing for which it can be good to have happiness or pleasure. And I think there's a way to notice this. If we notice a certain peculiarity of moral vision, this is an idea that Tal Brewer drew my attention to that I thought was really sort of profound on this point, where he says, sometimes you like listen to the news and you hear about like an earthquake that happens in Vietnam. Not really, not a lot of earthquakes in Vietnam. Indonesia, better example. An earthquake happens in Indonesia. And like lots of people are dying. And like, it doesn't bother you that much. Like, you know it should. You know it's a tragedy. And like, you should be really sad. You have a hard time summoning up the like empathy to care, right? And this is horrible, right? Maybe you're better than me and don't have this problem. But something you can do in this situation is you can remind yourself, you know, that person who died, that was someone's brother. That was someone's father. That was someone's daughter. That was someone's lover. And this is a little odd if you think about it for a second, because this does work, right? You can kind of grip the tragedy better. But like, why does reminding yourself this person was loved by people make it easier? If you didn't care about one stranger's death, is it any easier to care about several strangers' grief? What Tal Brewer says, and I think he's right, is that what this familiar discipline of vision then does is it's a way to remind ourselves the obvious fact that the value of a human being is seen more clearly from the vantage point of parents or children, friends or spouses. And that's because the value of a human being is seen more clearly through the eyes of love than through the aggregate of arithmetic of the utilitarian or the bureaucrat. You don't grasp the value of the disvalue of human suffering or the value of human life through a utilitarian lens, it's only clearly grasped through the eyes of love, which is why when you want to appreciate what really is good and bad in the world, you need to participate in a vantage point which makes that kind of perspective of love seem plausible. And this is really at the heart of a distinctively Thomistic understanding about the nature of good, that it must necessarily start with love, and as such, must necessarily start with a person or an animal, and not with happiness or pleasure. Okay. That's the utilitarian. What about the Kantian? I don't like this part. I have a lot of sympathy for Kant. I was a Kantian for many years of my life. It was a long, hard fight to convince me to be a Thomist rather than a Kantian. But I am now a Thomist rather than a Kantian. Why? Okay, the other problem is, like, Kant's difficult, but it's hard to give a sort of brief summary. The central problem with Kantianism, I believe, is that Kantian rational nature is too thin to support the weight and significance of moral reality, right? Many people made this point, that like there's not enough substance to the form of practical reason that you can like actually derive the substance of morality just by trying to get these formal contradictions, right? This is a very standard criticism of Kantian ethics. It won't make any sense to you unless you already know a lot more about Kantian ethics than I've explained so far, but don't worry, because I'm not gonna focus on that sort of complexity anyway. It was gonna take way too long to try to really like give the goods in that argument. So I'm gonna take a shortcut. I'm gonna take a shortcut by assuming that moral value is something that is well expressed through plausible expressions of grief. What I mean by that is, I take it that we express a recognition of moral value in statements like this that you see at the bottom of page 4. My God, what have I done? I've just destroyed a human life. Or my God, what have I done? That was someone's father, daughter, sister, brother. Or my God, what have I done? I just killed them. A person beloved by God and made in his image. These strike me, and maybe you prefer some of these other than others, as plausible things someone could say if they were a morally serious person who realized they just killed the person. Now contrast that with what seems to be the morally deep explanation of what's bad about killing someone if you are indeed a Kantian. And here we see it on the other side. My God, what have I done? I violated rational nature in another. Or, my God, what have I done? I betrayed my own rational nature. Or, my God, what have I done? I'm a traitor to reason. Now, at least to me, these expressions of remorse strike me as almost a parody of serious moral reasoning. They're too thin to get a grip on what it is that has the kind of significance that we want to attach to what something like death is. That you understand the badness of human death by understanding the rich reality of what a human life is, not by grasping the mere formal consistency mandated on human reality by the fact that we are reflective rational creatures. We can talk more about this argument in Q&A if people want to, right? But for reasons of time, Kant's complicated. There's a lot he can say in his defense, right? So we can come back to this if we need to. But that's the basic idea, that these sort of expressions of remorse show us the way in which our moral vocabulary really only has a grip when you use these thick moral concepts. The virtue terms like courage and cowardice of, you know, someone's beloved child, right? And not the thin notions that Kant treats as the moral primitives. Okay. If this is right, if the Aristotelian Thomistic picture is the fundamentally right one, it raises a puzzle. And so I'm going to talk about in part 3. And the way we can talk about this puzzle is, well, why in the world have we gone backwards? Right? If we've slowly progressed, like, you know, Aristotle was basically right, and like Thomas was even better, but then like Kant came along and he went wrong, and then utilitarians went even more wrong, and like now it's like, that's weird. And you might worry this is like someone who comes in who's like read way too much, like, sort of like Aristotle, and is like, modern science has all been going backwards. Aristotle had it right, and then Galileo came along, and he was like, we should be using numbers rather than qualitative features, and then Darwin came along and was like, there are no eternal species, and it's all flux, and then like Einstein said space and time are relative, and then quantum mechanics doesn't even have substances anymore. Like, we all need to go back to Aristotle, right? And like that might sound compelling, right? And it might if you have certain like traditionalist conservative sensibilities or kind of reactionary bone that you don't really want to have, but it's kind of a part of you. You might even like enjoy that sort of talk. But it has the distinctive disadvantage of being all nonsense. Science has gotten better, not worse. Right? And we should expect science to get better, not worse, because smart people thinking for a really long time using the benefits of previous people's thoughts improve over time. We should generally anticipate that smart people doing really serious academic work get better at figuring out what's true, not worse at figuring out what's true. And if that's true, then sure, I can tell you some compelling sounding arguments for why ethics was really better back in Aristotle's day, you know, minus all the really bad things people did, right? But I think you should be a little skeptical, right? It's at least surprising, right, that we seem to have the opposite trajectory in ethics than we did in physics. And maybe you should think that maybe I'm just like that, you know, reactionary Aristotelian who doesn't want to live with the times. Can I address this challenge? I think I can. This is the last part of the talk. First, I want to suggest that it's fundamentally wrong to think of ethics as akin to the empirical sciences. And that's because the empirical sciences are built on two things, discovery and understanding. If you go to the top of page 6, right, we can make evidence of this. So it is through discovery, it's through the discovery portion that the disciplines of empirical science really make progress. Thus, it's just true that I know more about the physical workings of our universe than Newton did. He didn't know anything about the Born rule. He couldn't tell you anything about the difference between special and general relativity. Right. I'm not great at physics, but like I probably have, in some sense, a more accurate picture of the basic fundamental mechanics of our universe than Newton. I don't understand the universe better than Newton did. Right? My understanding of the physical laws I know is much worse than Newton's understanding of the physical laws he knew. And so here, I can know more physics because I have the benefit of more discovery, even though I'm worse at the understanding part of what physics is. This is also why in introductory physics courses, it'd be very surprising if you like read Newton or Aristotle, right? It'd be kind of anachronistic. We like know more stuff now, and so it's better to present things with that more data taken in, right? We have the benefits of further discovery. Ethics, however, is quite different. And I think it's different because it doesn't have this element of discovery. There is no element of first you have to discover the facts, then you have to understand them. I think ethics is a pure process of understanding. Understanding what? Understanding those truths which we know simply in virtue of being human. That as humans, we have a grasp of moral reality that we know from the inside, and what ethics does is coming to understand that thing which we just know in through our humanity, not understand that thing which we had to spend a lot of time discovering. And this explains some of the clear differences between ethics and physics. In introductory ethics class, it'd be really weird if you don't read Aristotle or Plato or Kant. It'd be really weird in intro physics course if you do read Newton. It'd be really weird in intro ethics course if you don't read Aristotle. That's very different. What's more, it was impossible, for instance, to be a good doctor back in the 8th century. You were just probably going to kill people more than you helped them. Because you didn't know enough, right, about medicine. But while it was impossible to be a good doctor, it wasn't impossible to be a good person. There are no doctor saints from the ancient world, but there are more saints from the ancient world. There are people from the ancient world who we can read with deep admiration for their moral clarity. This is also why it'd be crazy for me to say I know more about ethics than Aristotle, Kant, Mill, Sidgwick, Aquinas, right? They understand these things better than me, and so they know more than me. There isn't that sort of difference that I can make in this kind of Newton case. And so we have this asymmetry. We have this asymmetry between, on the one hand, empirical science, which is a combination of understanding and discovery, and ethics, which is a pure activity of understanding, that which you don't need to discover. And it explains these kind of methodological differences that we notice in how these classes are done, and how we sort of compare ethicists and things of this sort. This is, you know, as a matter of fact, is also why, for example, we can like judge people and condemn them for being bad people in the ancient world. You know, we don't judge people being bad doctors in the 8th century. They couldn't help it. They couldn't but be bad doctors in the 8th century. But you can totally hold people, right, to not being good people. Like when, you know, a man commanding father's own slaves, that was bad and evil and we should condemn them for it. Though probably here at WNL you all get that debate often enough that I can, you know, move on to other things. Perhaps not yet convinced. Right. Sometimes people are like really convinced that we have made progress in ethical theory. So I want to give like one version of this argument real quick. Sometimes people point to the psychology of like in-group favoritism, right? I know people who like, look, especially like people sometimes have utilitarians, they're like, look, we've made real progress because like we keep expanding the circle. And we like recognize now that human psychology is deeply inclined towards this kind of racist in-group favoritism. We need to sort of expand to include other people. And this is true. Psychology does show this, and this is a sort of true moral insight. But I don't think it's a new idea. So if you look at the top of page 7, I have here a passage from Heraclitus, a second century Stoic, in which he says, "Each one of us is, as it were, entirely encompassed by many circles, some smaller, other larger, the later enclosing the former on the basis of their different unequal dispositions relative to each other. The first and closest circle is the one which a person is drawn as though around the center, his own mind. The circle encloses the body and anything taken for the sake of the body, for it is virtually the smallest circle. Next, the second one, further removed from the center, but enclosing the first, contains parents, siblings, wife, children. The third circle, uncles and aunts, grandparents, nephews, and so it goes on and on. We can jump to the end. Once these have all been surveyed, it is the task of a well-tempered man in his proper treatment of each group to draw the circles together, somehow towards the center, and to keep zealously transferring those from the enclosing circles into the enclosed ones. It is incumbent on us to respect people from the third circle as if they were those from the second, and again to respect our other relatives as if they were those from the third circle again." I've heard in conversation people say, like, you know, Peter Singer discovered the phenomenon of like morality being a matter of expanding the circle. Like, no! Literally that exact metaphor was used in the second century by Stoic philosophers, right? It's true that as a society we make progress in like the treatment of individual people and things like that, but that's very different than saying we make progress in our understanding of the fundamental principles of ethical theory. This is indeed something that Kant himself said. In a criticism, a book review written by his Groundwork, he responds to in the second critique. And he says, "Someone criticized my book, The Groundwork, because it offered no new moral principles." And he says, "But who could want to offer new moral principle as though humanity could have ever been thoroughgoing ignorance about how to live? All he offered, he claimed, was a new formulation of that which we already knew." So if there is no moral discovery, what is going on in explaining the change in ethical theory? Well, because there's no discovery, I don't think it's plausible to think that it's a matter of discovering new things or improvement. Instead, what I think it is fundamentally is a matter of abstraction and generalization. So what happens over time is the theory, because of the theoretical nature of the science, gets more and more abstract, focusing on more and more abstract elements. So first you think about like details of human nature, and you think about the merely formal aspects of rational nature, and then you think it's not just rational nature, it's like any living thing that can experience pleasure and pain. And you get sort of more generalized and more abstract stories, which are, for the most part, deeply insightful, because when you abstract, you often understand that which you're abstracting better than you did before. And so I do think utilitarians tend to be better at recognizing the fact that animal suffering is just as bad as human suffering, which I think it is. And I think Kant tends to be better at understanding the way in which we're required to respect people in ways that Aristotle didn't get, because he believed in natural slaves. But while that abstraction can provide local kinds of clarity, you always have to remember it is an abstraction from that thorough reality that we already had. And so I want to end with what I have as the epigraph at the top of this handout, this passage by C.S. Lewis, because I think it gets at something important. He says, "There has never been and never will be a radically new judgment of value in the history of the world. What purport to be more systems all consist of fragments from the Tao, fragments of morality, arbitrarily wrenched from their context of the whole and then swollen to madness and isolation, yet still owing to the Tao and to it alone such valid validity as they possess." And this is right. I think, and this should be encouraging to us. It should be encouraging in two ways. First, to think we can learn a lot from reading people like Kant and Sidgwick. And second, to think we can learn from them without having to do so in a kind of nervous way. Sometimes I, as a Catholic, feel like, what if they have a really good argument that like I haven't dealt with and it's going to like undermine, like they made a new discovery about ethics and like showing my morality was totally wrong. I don't think we have to worry about that because I just don't think it's the sort of thing that ethicists do. And I think this should encourage us to take these texts really seriously, these things we can learn from, without having to be sort of defensive or worried about engaging with them as though they could pose some sort of real threat. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.